Okay. Well, welcome everybody to the hybrid John Jay Homestead and to our temporary venue, maybe for another year or two. So at some point, it's not temporary. I'm Melissa Vail, trustee of the Friends and chair of the Lectures Committee, and we're excited to have you here in person and many more of you on screen. Welcome, especially to the teachers and students in both parts of our audience, and please turn off your phones. Webinar logistics for our remote attendees. If you have a problem, use the chat function and we'll have questions later. And you can certainly ask your questions by using the chat function too. Thank yous to the Bedford Playhouse for taking us in during this construction and renovation time. And please, everyone, look at the Friends website for the news of what we're doing in the house. Special thanks to our lectures committee back here for their support of these talks. And of course, to our outstanding public partner, the New York State Office of Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation for everything. And as always, and most important, our members who are our reason for being. Thank you to all of you who are already members, and thank you to all of you who are about to sign up and become members. We have a whole lot of other things happening this spring, including the opening of our farm market next Saturday and the final talk in this series on Tuesday, May 23rd. Sarah Cedar Miller, who's the historian of Central Park, who's writing about before Central Park. Now, here's a Zoom feature that we're keeping, which is the survey. I'm going to ask you a question, and I want a lightning response with no overthinking. Our finest mathematicians will report on our in-person and online answers, which are often, interestingly, different. Here is the survey. What do you think is the most important function of our Constitution? To give government the powers it needs to govern, to protect individuals against government action, or both? It's a balance. So here we go. Get ready to raise your hands. What's the most important function of our Constitution? To give government the powers it needs? Raise your hand. Okay, that's at maybe 15%. To protect individuals against government action? That's another couple. And then both, it's a balance. There we go. Okay. And then Emily will tell us how people voted online. About the same. Okay. Okay.
Landslide, it's a balance.
It's a balance. Okay, well, that was probably too easy. I'm going to have to come back to you with a different question. Now, this is the last part from me before you get to hear from our speaker. Those of you who have come to our talks before know that we always look for a J connection to the topic of the evening. Tonight, we could have had a million connections with this book, but we're going to zero in on Jay and the Federalist Papers, which, of course, were a series of newspaper essays published under a pseudonym to encourage the ratification of the US Constitution by the highly influential state of New York to decide, in the words of Alexander Hamilton, the important question whether societies of men are really capable or not of establishing good government from reflection and choice, or whether they are forever destined to depend for their political constitutions on accident and force. Jay wrote five of the 85 essays, mostly the outward-facing ones concerned with foreign affairs, and I'm going to zero in on number 64, the powers of the Senate, specifically the power to make treaties. There are what we'll call some charming anachronisms there, and there have been some changes to the structure of government, but the basic provision holds that the power to make treaties belongs to the president, but he needs the advice and consent of two-thirds of the Senate. Some of these anachronisms include the election of the president by the Electoral College is better than direct election, where, quote, the activity of party zeal taking the advantage of the supineness, the ignorance, and the hopes and fears of the unwary and uninterested, often places men, unwary and interested, often places men in office by the votes of a small proportion of the electors. Or how about the electors, quote, will in general be composed of the most enlightened and respectable citizens. And since senators were then chosen by state legislatures, those bodies, quote, would not be liable to be deceived by those brilliant appearances of genius and patriotism, which, like transient meteors, sometimes mislead as well as dazzle. Then what to do about treaties formed by fraud or dishonor, considering that they are the supreme law of the land and not modifiable by Congress? Quote, the motive to good behavior is amply afforded by the article on the subject of impeachments. So our speaker will no doubt help us figure out how our Constitution managed to last so long. So Professor Dame Linda Colley is a British-born historian whose field can be inadequately described as British, imperial, and global history since 1700. She earned her PhD at Cambridge University, where she was the first female fellow of Christ's College. She's currently the Shelby M.C. Davis 1958 Professor of History at Princeton. She's written 7 books in addition to this one. They've won multiple prizes and awards. She holds multiple honorary degrees, is a fellow of multiple learned societies and academies, and has delivered multiple named lectures in Britain and internationally.
And I go home now.
I know, I couldn't count them all up.
It's not going to get any better.
No, it is. It's getting better. In 2022, Linda received the Order of the British Empire, DBE, Dame of the Order of the British Empire, as part of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II's Platinum Jubilee Birthday Honors. So she is our first dame. Welcome, Linda Colley.
Thank you.
So before we get to your marvelous book, in our survey answers, are we right?
Well, I'm not a US citizen, so I have to be tactful here. I was very struck that it was most of you opted for both.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that's right.
Or maybe it started with one model and maybe constitutions are developing in another direction toward the more modern ones. We'll talk about that. Hold that thought. To my first real question for you is, what is a constitution and what was the first one?
If you're talking about some people say, the ancient Greeks had constitutions, or there were constitutions written on stone in places like Mesopotamia. And that's true at one level, but many of these early constitutions were really sets of laws. They were not widely distributed. I mean, you could hardly widely distribute a block of stone. Most people, after all, couldn't read. In those earlier times, there was no printing press. And it's no accident at all that the growing proliferation of political constitutions of the sort we take for granted now is really getting going in the mid-18th century as literacy expands in parts of the world, as printing presses proliferate. And there's a realization that you can't take people for granted so much, that it's advantageous for polities if they distribute codes of law, because people can now read and react to them. And there's another reason that we'll come back to, I'm sure, that what I argue in this book is that the rise of constitutions, the spread of constitutions from, say, the mid 18th century onwards, some earlier than that actually, is closely connected often to patterns of war. Because if you want to raise taxes for wars, if you want to raise men, and warfare is becoming more and more expensive and large scale and cross-continental at this time, then you've really got to work out, well, how are we going to get citizens organized to pay the taxes? How are we going to get men to agree to fight in large numbers? And there's close links, and political scientists have made this point quite a lot. There's a close link between the spread of conscription in different parts of the world and the spread of constitutions. Basically, you extend the vote to men, of course, not initially to women, but to men increasingly, because you need them to fight if need be. And that happens very much in South America, which by 1850, much of South America is, I have to say it, more democratic than the United States, because among men, because there's so many wars in South America. And therefore, there's constant pressure to let not just white males vote, but to enfranchise indigenous men, freed slaves. And the electorate in parts of South America is really zooming up in the 19th century in tandem with wars. But I think you asked what was the first constitution, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Well, this is an American audience. You won't like this. It wasn't the one, I'm afraid, drafted in Philadelphia in 1787. Perhaps one of the earliest recognized written constitutions that brought in large levels of male democracy, it was in a context of war again, is the Corsican Constitution of 1755. Most people haven't heard of it because there weren't printing presses in Corsica at that time. They had to distribute it in manuscript. But Sweden has a new written constitution in 1772. In fact, Sweden is experimenting with recognizably modern written constitutions in the 1720s. So none of them have the immediate impact of the American Constitution because, of course, the American Constitution is so twinned with the American Revolution. And also the United States has a fantastic printing industry. And it's those things which bring the US Constitution into much wider stretches of the world than previous written constitutions, but it was not the first.
So we, about the revolution, we are taught to almost think of the American Revolution as a costume drama, with our colonies being the main actors in that. But you describe it as the greatest hybrid war in history. And what do you mean by that? And what does that do to our telling of our own history? This is back to really about American exceptionalism. We're all going to dump on American exceptionalism here.
I can leave now. when I use this phrase hybrid war in this book, I use it in a particular way. When war strategists use that term now, hybrid war, they mean something rather different. They mean that you're using intelligence techniques, mercenaries, all kinds of bizarre computer systems. That obviously isn't what I mean when I use the term hybrid warfare there. What I mean by that is the growing tendency in the 18th and 19th and 20th century to be fighting wars at sea as well as on land. Hideously expensive thing to do. And I mean, it was crucial for the success of the American Revolution that there was an alliance, as you know, with France in 1778, which brought in its very large navy to aid the Americans, not just troops on land, but these big fighting warships. And without that naval aid to counter the British Royal Navy, it would have been very, very difficult for the American revolutionaries to win, if at all. But it was so expensive that the French state was bankrupt. That's what the French got from supporting the American Revolution. The crown was bankrupted, and that was a major cause of the outbreak of the French Revolution in 1789, which again leads to new constitutions. So again and again, you see patterns of war, patterns of changing war, giving rise to new constitutional exercises, new constitutional writings. So I wanted to get that over to make it clear that it isn't just ideas of political rights, though they were very important. You had to have imperatives for states to take the risk of making new constitutions. And war was a case in point. And war also helps to explain what the men of Philadelphia were doing in 1787, because the new American Republic is left badly in debt itself. The feedback it's getting from the different states in terms of fiscal help is very, very poor. And one of the things the men of Philadelphia want to do in 1787, yes, they want to give more rights, but they also want to increase the degree of federal reach. And they want to tie up their system of government much better so that powers will be willing to trade with the new USA. Powers will be willing to lend it money, which is absolutely vital because there isn't much money around, as Hamilton knows. And so you've got to make it clear, not just to Americans, but to the world at large, particularly to the Europeans, that the United States is now set up on a sound foundation. And I think that too is a recurrent pattern, that we think very often of written constitutions just being read by the citizens of the country concerned, but they're also often intended as ways to publicize a state to the rest of the world, to show that it's creditworthy, to show that it's got interesting ideas about government, that it is serious. And that audience outside the borders may be almost as important as citizens within the borders for what you write in a constitution.
And so you really talk hardly at all about the Declaration of Independence.
Well, So many other people have written about the Declaration of Independence. There's a great Harvard historian, David Armitage, whose book on the Declaration I thoroughly recommend. But in fact, the Declaration of Independence, in terms of global reach, doesn't have for a long while all that much impact. If you look at how many translations there are of the Declaration of Independence, it only really takes off outside the Americas in the 20th century, when you're getting a whole lot of new independent states being created. But what people are really interested in getting translations of is the American Constitution. That document takes off much faster.
I could go in two different directions. So first, we will talk about legislatures and how citizen participation is getting much more broad and democratic and more diverse. And you also talk about Napoleon. And you dig into your argument that constitutions are what governments offer their populace so that they can tax and draft them more successfully. But then you talk about how in some ways Napoleon was successful and in some ways he was a failure. So take us through that a little bit.
Napoleon was a failure in that he lost the Battle of Waterloo. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was it. But for a long while, he was very successful in conquering huge swathes of continental Europe. And at the same time, in many areas, in different parts of Italy, in the German lands, in Holland, in Spain, he is spreading this device of written constitutions. And that's often thought of as a sign, oh, he must have been a good guy. He must have been liberal. Well, in some ways, I mean, you know, Napoleon is a remarkable man. He is liberal in some respects. I mean, he's very keen in the places he conquers to, for example, improve toleration of Jews. And he tends to write that into all his constitutions. But what he's also keen to do is, of course, to cement this new empire he's creating new systems of government in his conquests. And if you look at the Napoleonic constitutions, they are, however liberal, they are saying, we need more taxes from you. And this particular state has to contribute so many men to an expanded French army. So that's the quid pro quo for getting a Napoleonic constitution, which in some ways is liberal, often gives extensive voting rights for men, forget about women. But the quid pro quo is, I want to ensure taxes from my conquered lands and you give us men. Because many of the men in the French army that, for example, marches disastrously into Moscow in 1812, many of them are not French. They are guys from these various conquered regions. Some of them as far away as from Egypt, which is where Napoleon tried at one stage to create a kind of Muslim state. And indeed, he has this wonderful, you can see how grandiose he is. Napoleon at one stage says, I'm going to be like Muhammad. I'm not going to carry the Quran. I am going to carry a set of political rules. So, you know, this is this is Napoleonic grandiosity, but his idea that writing things down is really important. And this was something else I wanted to stress in the book, that the growth of written constitutions coincides not just with changing patterns of war, but, for example, the rise of the novel. When you think about what are novels, they're stories. They invent a place. They invent characters. And many of the people who are involved in writing constitutions are interested in other kinds of writing. And Napoleon's a great example. As a young man, he is himself from Corsica and has learned about the 1755 Corsican constitution. But he tries out many different kinds of writing, including trying his hand at novels, writing history books, doing journalism. He's very interested in the use of words. And I do think constitutions should not just be studied by lawyers and historians and political scientists. They are also very often kinds of literature, and they need to be integrated more into other forms of writing.
Back to your discussion of the conscripts from these conquered lands. Did they, when those who returned from the march to Moscow or places like that, or these terrible battles, did they assimilate into any sort of French culture? Where did they go back to? And did this military service entitle them to any ongoing social equality or social participation in their countries?
Well, of course, when Napoleon fell, a lot of these political experiments fell with him. Mm-hmm. But some people have started researching this recently, and some of Napoleon's army officers who came from different backgrounds went into different countries. A lot of them went to South America and spread constitutional ideas there. Because it wasn't just Napoleon's own conscripts. It was also people who came into contact with these conscripts who, in some cases, got new ideas. So you get a surge of constitution experimentation in Italy, even after Napoleon is vanquished. Even in Russia, you get there's a big rising, the Decembrist rising in the mid-1820s. And many of these fighters who want a more liberal Russia, they've fought against Napoleon and the French, but they're still very interested in some of the ideas and experiments that Napoleon has been trying.
So let's stay with Russia for a minute. You talk about Catherine the Great as being, vulnerable and also powerful and vulnerable at the same time. How did that work, and how did that affect her experiments with different constitutional structures? And then let's talk about her heirs and what's happening in Ukraine now with experiments with constitutionalism. And is Putin, can he be considered at all an heir of Catherine the Great? What do we do about that?
Well, let me start by saying that one of the things I tried to do in this book was to bring in people that are not normally associated with the rise of constitutionalism. Yes, we've heard about Hamilton, we know about Washington, we know about Jefferson and so on and so forth, we know about Madison and Jay. But I wanted to bring in other people. Quite a lot of the book is about non-white constitution writers, particularly in the Pacific area. Hawaii was a great place for constitution making, really from 1840 onwards. But it wasn't easy for me to find women, because until after the First World War, most constitutional writing is exclusively masculine. So I was really pleased to come across an aspect of Catherine the Great that I hadn't known about before I wrote this book. Catherine the Great is often known mainly because of her actual or purported sex life. And that has always been the case. I mean, there have been so many films and TV series about Catherine the Great, and they always talk about her private life or not so private life. And she was certainly a woman of exuberant appetites, but she was also extremely clever. She was very interested in the Enlightenment. She herself, again, is a writer. She writes her own books, books for children, books of philosophy, and so forth. Very influenced by Enlightenment figures like Montesquieu. But she's an outsider. By birth, she's German. She is brought into, she's a German princess. She's brought into an arranged marriage by the man who becomes Peter, Tsar Peter, in the early 1760s. It is not a marriage made in heaven. Catherine is almost immediately unfaithful. He has his own interests. And when he becomes Tsar, Catherine takes part in a plot against him, a plot which dethrones Peter. Subsequently, he is strangled. And Catherine, instead of looking after the throne until her own legitimate son is old enough, just declares herself Tsar. I am the new ruler of the Russian Empire. But she has a very dangerous job because she's been involved in the destruction of her husband. So what if someone endeavors to destroy her? She's a foreigner, a usurper. So one of the ways she tries to do this and makes herself more serious is that she drafts this remarkable document called the Nakaz, the Great Law Code, which is about 300 pages long, has an enormous impact. Jefferson buys a copy when it's translated into English, and it's translated into about 15 different languages. And some of the contents of the Nakaz are very enlightened indeed. She starts talking about welfare policies, for example. And she holds a convention. She has elections throughout different parts of the Russian Empire to elect representatives to come to St. Petersburg and then to Moscow to discuss the terms of this Nakaz. So here we are, delegates from all over these huge Russian lands coming to St. Petersburg to discuss a paper text. This is in the 1760s. So now nothing in the end comes of the Nakaz. It helps to give Catherine greater legitimacy. It allows her to play with ideas, but it isn't implemented. But it is translated widely. It helps build up ideas and momentum, these growing number of paper texts of government that you're getting in the second half of the 18th century and beyond. And as I say, a female author. So she begins my chapter two.
So her successor, a couple of generations later, Vladimir Putin, certainly is up against the bargain for how to get money and conscripts for very, very expensive wars. What is he thinking? Is there any deal? What was the constitutional relationship between Ukraine and the Soviet Union or Russia before this war? And who's going to figure out how to restore it? What's that about?
I am not privy to Putin's thoughts, but don't think I'd want to be. The relations between Ukraine and Russia are very, very complex and go back a long way. You know, Russia was a mighty empire under the Tsars, often expanding into surrounding territory, into Turkey, into Central Asia, into Alaska. Remember that the Russians sold Alaska to the United States. They needed money. It would have been so interesting had they kept hold of it. Interesting new frontier conflicts, perhaps. But of course, the Tsarist Empire fell with the Russian Revolution in 1917. Then you had the buildup of the Soviet Empire. And then, of course, a lot of that disintegrated with the fall of the Soviet Union. But, you know, once the empire bug has bit you, it's difficult to give it up. And I mean, it's understandable from his point of view that Putin is interested in expansion, with the catastrophic results that we see. What I think I can be sure of saying, I have no idea what's going to happen. Ukraine is remarkably brave, but Russia has an endless supply of manpower, as Napoleon found in 1812 and as Hitler found in the 1940s. So this could get very messy and last for a long time. Whichever way it ends, if it ends in a decisive victory one way or the other, we can expect constitutional repercussions. If Ukraine is soundly defeated, it will be absorbed into an expanded Russia. There will be a puppet ruler and there will be a different constitution imposed on it, I'm sure. Conversely, if Russia fails embarrassingly, Putin may fall, in which case you may get a new Russian constitution, written constitution, because again, one of the things that constitutions do, picking up on my earlier point, that they're not just for domestic consumption, you're also using them to address the world. There may be a new post-Putin constitution re-representing what Russia is about and legitimizing a new Russia for a new period of time. So there will be constitutional activism, I'm sure, whatever happens.
You have a really interesting discussion about constitutions that are imposed by conquerors. And you say that we can probably accept that Germany and Japan ended up with constitutions that have succeeded, but Iraq, not so much. And then what about the Confederate States of America? Talk about the difference, about why some constitutions imposed by conquerors succeed and some don't.
Well, let's start with the Southern states. Yes, I mean, when the South tried to secede, it one of the first things it did was to set up its own new written constitution, which actually has points in common with the constitution that they were seceding from, except a very, very explicit insistence on slavery, that it was not to be abolished ever. That was the nugget of this new South constitution. Of course, when the South is defeated and you get all these amendments started when Lincoln was still thinking about it, and then after his assassination continuing, in many ways, of course, those amendments didn't succeed. Reconstruction was put to one side. So the conquerors there, for a variety of reasons, let the reconstruction of the South to the benefit of its Black population push to one side, though the amendments remained there as writing and in law. And once you've got something in writing and in print, that's a start, even if it isn't being implemented. In Germany and Japan, after the Second World War, yes, constitution making, in part by the Allies, but also by liberal jurists, liberal German jurists, in Germany, obviously, and some Japanese liberal or comparatively liberal jurists there. Those constitutions stuck. But I think one of the reasons why they were able to stick was that those countries, Japan and Germany, had quite a long history in each case of written constitutions. So some of the vocabulary, some of the conventions they understood. Japan had created its first constitution, a really important constitution, the Meiji Constitution in 1887. And the first East Asian constitution. And it was really, really important, not just for Japan, because in some ways it seems a very conservative constitution, conservative with small c, but for many non-Western actors, opponents of Western colonialism, independence fighters, the fact that Japan, a non-Western country, had created a successful constitution in 1887. And that constitution stuck. It lasted until the defeat of the Second World War. That was very important for pro-independent activists wanting to struggle against the West, because they could say, look, written constitutions is not just a Western device. Other kinds of people, other kinds of religious groupings, other geographies can do it. So I think that was part of the reason why the constitution making in Japan and Germany, both defeated powers in the Second World War, that was able to succeed, because there was a constitutional background in both countries.
Mm-hmm. But in Iraq?
Nothing. No. Yeah, not in the same way.
Yeah. There are some other conversations you have about the cultures in which constitutions grow or are imposed, and talk a little bit about how constitutions are different where women are not marginalized and the indigenous are not excluded on the one hand. And on the other hand, you talk about Haiti and Saint-Domingue, where it had a populace that you describe as poor, illiterate, and trained to violence. What about cultures of the countries where constitutions either take root or don't?
Yeah. There is so much diversity in constitutions, I should say. I mean, writing this book at times drove me mad. I know it is more fun to read because you don't see the kind of that it involved, partly because there was so much to read, but also there was so much to write with the diversity of these instruments. But partly I wanted to get that over, that written constitutions are not just about the spread of democracy. They are not just instruments that have been used by nation states. Empires have had written constitutions. When Japan created its 1887 constitution, it was an empire. It had an emperor. Imperialism was on the rise as it moved into Korea and increasingly into China. So to think that written constitutions just move in one trajectory and take one form is obviously not on. The women thing I was really intrigued with. I mentioned Catherine the Great as a kind of early constitution writer. The Nakaz wasn't a constitution, but in some ways it came close. But in terms of guaranteeing votes for women, that was a very long struggle. And that was partly to do with constitutions' close links with warfare. Until the First World War and the spread of industry and women having to move into factories to make war machinery and so forth, the idea that women could be useful in wars was not very developed. Therefore, states did not feel any sense of necessity, really, of giving them the vote. I mean, you know, of course, there were liberals who believed it was right that women should be enfranchised. But governments, which tend to be pretty ruthless institutions, would say, well, yeah, it's a nice idea, but, you know, we've got other things to do. But when you have the nature of war shifting, where you've got to get women into the factories, where you're building up regiments of women to help the army or the air force or in the navy, then of course the same pattern begins to apply. And you know, Woodrow Wilson says this. Woodrow Wilson starts the First World War utterly opposed to women's franchise. By the end of World War I, he says, women have earned the vote. They have helped to fight the war. And for him, this is absolutely crucial. But the first place that enfranchised women on a permanent basis was not really fighting a war. It did so in a small and eccentric way. The tiny island of Pitcairn in the Pacific, where the mutineers from the Bounty end up. And Pitcairn in 1837, 1838 has about 100 people on it. Mixed race, the progeny of these mutineers and their Tahitian companions. And a Royal Navy captain comes along to Pitcairn, and the Pitcairners say, you know, it's really nasty. All these fishermen and whalers from places like Nantucket, they keep landing here and they want our stuff. And they say, well, you haven't got a constitution. You're not real. You're not real. You're not a state. Clearly, you don't have a constitution. You can't be a real state. And so this Royal Navy captain writes them a constitution. And he must have been an idealist. He was clearly a very interesting man. He was a Scot. And he says, you've got to be born in Pitcairn or have lived there for a certain number of years. You've got to be 21 years old. But all men and women who have those qualifications can vote. And that sticks. So that's the very first place, because a few women had been able to vote in New Jersey after the American Revolution, because the New Jersey state constitution gave the vote to some women of property. But at the beginning of the 19th century, the males of New Jersey noticed this aberrant provision, and it was done away with.
Yeah, about that.
But Pitcairn keeps going. Of course, it's a tiny, tiny, fragile population. But it's interesting, again, that these ideas, the way they're spreading and the influence of writing in a tiny patch of earth in the middle of the ocean.
Wonderful. I have one more point, and then we're going to have time for a very small number of questions from the audience. And that is, I have a favorite clause from a constitution, from the 1825 Constitution of Chihuahua, where ungrateful children are deprived of citizenship. That's my favorite one. Do you have a favorite, either that one or a different one? That was, someone was in a mood when they wrote that.
No, I noticed that. I thought that was irresistible when I came across that. This is in a part of Mexico. And Mexico in the early 1820s really gets caught up in this, oh, you know, we're independent now. We can have our own constitutions. And so tiny little townships like this start drafting their own constitutions. And, you know, people say, hey, I've got an idea for a provision. Ungrateful children, kick them out of citizenship. And this improvisation, what can a constitution do? And in a sense, we've come back to improvisation now. And it's, I think, one of the challenges for the US Constitution, which is difficult to amend, particularly in these political circumstances.
This afternoon, the Senate stopped the progress of the Equal Rights Amendment 100 years after it was proposed. So that's dead after 100 years for real, until someone finds another way to activate it.
But you see, it seems to me that this is going to become more and more of a problem, not just for partisan reasons or for convention, some of the more established notions like the one you mentioned, but a lot of new constitutions now or newly amended constitutions, they're doing things like, well, how can we improve the environment? How do we think about more reparations for Indigenous people? Can we restructure a written constitution so that these newer imperatives can be included in it, not just the construction of a Supreme Court or the nature of the franchise, all of which we rightly take for granted and assume, but what other ways can these extraordinary instruments be made to serve not just the government of the state, but the will and the welfare of the people, all the people. And if you're going to have this kind of improvisation, it's hard to get that if a constitution is difficult to amend. And I think that's going to be something that American lawyers, American politicians, American publics are increasingly going to be talking about.
Mm-hmm. So we can take two questions. Two. Emily, you get to choose.
Thank you so much. I was wondering if you could speak about the meaning of Britain's unwritten constitution.
Thank you. That was one of my questions, and I didn't think I had time to ask it, but you did.
Well, yeah, it's a fantastic question. How long have you got? How many days are you prepared to sit here? It isn't, of course, entirely unwritten. But it isn't in a single codified document. The British Constitution is so-called, it's an amalgam of the common law, of parliamentary statutes, of various legal decisions, of great pieces of legislation like the British Bill of Rights of 1689. But, you know, it's huge and diffuse, and nobody knows it, even lawyers, you know, I mean, it's so diffuse and multivalent. I suspect that this is going to change. I mean, some of the changes have already happened. Britain does now have a Supreme Court. And I had thought that if Scotland became independent, that and we know that the Scottish nationalists would like a written constitution for Scotland. But the Scottish nationalists at the moment are in such a state that I'm afraid Scottish independence is not really on the books for the foreseeable future. But I had rather, I mean, I don't really want my country of origin to disaggregate, but I had thought that perhaps that would give a kick in favour of constitutional revision. But I don't think that's going to happen. And again, I think one can link this with patterns of war. If Britain had been defeated in World War I or World War II, if it had been invaded, if it had been occupied like so many other parts of continental Europe were, well, for a start, I think the monarchy might well have gone. And I think once the Nazis were driven out, or the Germans were driven out in World War I, there would have been again this motive to draft a new constitution to create a new story for a restored nation. But none of that happened. I mean, there hasn't been a revolution in the island of Great Britain since the 17th century. There's been no successful invasion of the island of Britain since the 17th century. And apart from the American Revolutionary War, which happened beyond the seas, there has been no big defeat in war. And I think this has helped preserve this rather ramshackle legal system, which really does need change.
Are there other major countries, so something larger than Pitcairn Island, that do not have constitutions in addition to to Britain?
Israel and New Zealand.
Oh, that's interesting.
There we go.
Israel, I only learned this a few weeks ago. One of the arguments that Israeli constitutional lawyers make for the lack of a conventional written constitution is that highly orthodox Jewish figures, as Israel came to be created, said, well, you know, we have these religious texts.
Right.
These are the basis of the new Israel. We don't need a secular text. That was not the unanimous view, but I was interested to hear from an Israeli constitutional lawyer that that argument had been made at the birth of Israel by some Orthodox activists.
I'm afraid we have to, we really have to stop. And thank you for taking us all around the world and all the way through history and through actual and would-be empires tonight. We could have spent at least twice as long talking about this. Everyone, please come back and join us with Sarah Cedar Miller. And now we have left you with plenty of time to go and get your hats for the Kentucky Derby and the Coronation and the Central Park Ladies Committee Lunch. So thank you for coming, and we hope to see you again. And Linda will be signing books up in the lobby. So come and join her there.
Thank you.
Buy lots of books.